Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 475, titled Prior Offenses, being recorded on September 12th of 2004. By the way, Prior is spelled P-R-Y-O-R. It's named after Samuel Fraser Prior, Sr. and Jr., two of the focal points of this broadcast, so note that. Note also that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire is a CD duplication service that stocks all of the various lectures and programs I've done over the years. I do not get money from this arrangement with Spitfire. You can visit the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. It's equipped with Real Audio and contains the most recently recorded pair of half-hour segments. The For the Record section of the Spitfire website has detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs available in sections that are noted. Be aware also that the Spitfire website is equipped with a search function. It also features the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the late heroic Paul Manning for download for free. There's also a link to a website put together by listeners in the Midwest that actually contains some of the documents that prove the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. Time permitting, we're going to take a look at a couple of those documents later on in this broadcast. So please take advantage of the Spitfire website. Again, if you only listen to the programs on the radio, you're missing a lot of the effort because the Spitfire website has a tremendous amount of information. It's there, it's available, it's for free, and listeners are strongly, emphatically encouraged to use the Spitfire website and the various links to it to build your own database. Now, in Prior Offenses, we've been taking a look at Samuel Fraser Prior, Sr. and Jr., two people who were part of the Bush Harriman business milieu, and Samuel Fraser Prior, Sr. was also a key director of two of the Bush family's Nazi-linked businesses, Union Banking Corporation and the American Ship and Shipping and Commerce Corporation, the parent company of the Hamburg America Line. We also took a look on side one at the fact that the Nye Vandenberg Committee found that Remington Arms, headed up by Samuel Fraser Prior, had shipped arms to German Reichs, including the Nazis, in the early 1930s. We took a look at Kevin Phillips' speculation about the possibility that the Hamburg America Line and Samuel Fraser Prior's position on that and Remington may have permitted those Remington arms to find their way to the German Reichs in the early 1930s. By the way, even before Hitler came to power, Fritz Thyssen, the Bush family's business partner, was channeling money to Adolf Hitler, and some of this networking goes back to the early 20s. That was when George Herbert Walker joined up with the Union Banking Corporation, which was helping Thyssen to channel money to the German rightists, to the German Nazis, I should say. And in the same time period, Thyssen was helping to finance the Rossbach Freikorps. That was a group of paramilitary operatives in the Saarland that included at that time Martin Bormann. So that's when Thyssen, the Bush's business partner, got to know Martin Bormann in this very same time period. Now, after taking a look at the fact that Remington arms, found their way to German Reichs and Nazis in the early 30s, possibly courtesy of the Hamburg America Line and probably in some capacity courtesy of Samuel Fraser Prior Sr., we took a look at the senior Samuel Prior's position as a director of both Union Banking Corporation and American Shipping and Commerce, the parent of Hamburg America Line. We also took a look at the fact that in 1934, Remington arms were seen as the source of weaponry for a coup plot that took place in the United States. Many of the power elite of the United States conspired to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and to set up a fascist government with a Marine Corps general as a figurehead. But Smedley Butler, the fellow they chose to lead the coup, betrayed the coup instead to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who in turn leaked it to the media. There was a congressional investigation, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which backed up Smedley Butler's allegations. And again, Remington arms were to be used for the American coup, as they had been used successfully for the overthrow of the German government and the replacement of the German government by the Nazis. Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. died in 1934. One wonders whether he was in some way involved with the coup plotting, whether his business partners, the Bushes, were involved with that coup plotting. There is no evidence that that's the case, but certainly one wonders, with Pryor having headed up Remington Arms and with him being a key director of two Nazi-linked businesses, that's certainly a possibility that is intriguing and that needs to be further researched. Now, we are looking in this program at Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr.'s role in some other Nazi-linked Republican Party machinations. The junior Samuel Fraser Pryor, who became a key director of Harriman Securities Corporation, part of the same milieu, was chairman of the Republican National Committee in 1940. In 1940, the Republicans nominated Wendell Willkie to challenge Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the Germans, who very much, the Nazis at this point, who very much wanted to defeat Franklin Roosevelt, channeled some $15 million to American campaigns in 1940. Bear in mind, it's a whole lot more money than it would be today, and that a lot of this money went to the Republican Party in turn to be channeled to defeating Franklin Delano Roosevelt. One of the sources for this German money was a very powerful Texas oil man and business wheeler dealer named William Rhodes Davis, who was actually a registered German spy. He was an actual agent, paid agent, for the Abwehr, German military intelligence. William Rhodes Davis was one of the conduits through which Nazi money found its way to the Republican Party in 1940 to help defeat Roosevelt. And one of the things that William Rhodes Davis did was to take John L. Lewis, head of the United Mine Workers and head of the Congress of Industrial Organizations and an opponent of Roosevelt's, to basically campaign actively on behalf of Wendell Willkie and to give a speech on behalf of Wendell Willkie in order to convince blue-collar workers not to support Franklin Roosevelt. And again, in these activities, William Rhodes Davis and John L. Lewis were conspiring with Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr., the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And as is made clear in the book Mystery Man, William Rhodes Davis, a Nazi agent of influence in America, that's the text from which I'm about to read, it was very well known by 1940 that William Rhodes Davis was operating on behalf of the Nazis, so the notion that Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. would not have known of William Rhodes Davis's Nazi activities is highly unlikely. So in side one, we took a look at Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr. Now we're going to take a look at Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. and his collaborative efforts, both with Nazi agent William Rhodes Davis and with the Third Reich, to help defeat Franklin Delano Roosevelt and elect Wendell Willkie. Once again, we're going to turn to the book Mystery Man, subtitled William Rhodes Davis, American Nazi Agent of Influence by Dale Harrington, published in softcover by Brassies. Of the efforts of William Rhodes Davis and the Germans on behalf of Wendell Willkie, Franklin Roosevelt's opponent in 1940, we read, "Not surprisingly, following the Germans' lead, Davis aided Willkie's campaign by contributing large amounts of money. He directly gave at least $48,000. To sidestep the federal limit of $5,000 in campaign donations, Davis used several methods. He gave each of his family members $3,000 to $4,000 to donate to the Willkie campaign. He made contributions to individual Republican Party state committees. He also persuaded several of his longtime business associates, including Ben Smith, to become financial supporters of Willkie. Davis decided that it would be best for Lewis to support the Republican candidate. In return for Lewis's endorsement, Davis wanted Lewis appointed U.S. Labor Secretary if Willkie were elected. In early July, Lewis predicted that Willkie would defeat Roosevelt in the fall. Despite efforts to reconcile Lewis with the Roosevelt administration, Lewis remained staunchly opposed to the president's re-election. Knowing of Lewis's implacable hostility to Roosevelt's candidacy, Davis opened negotiations with the Willkie camp." What we're going to read about next is Davis's work directly with Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr., the chairman of the Republican National Committee. In early September, Davis telephoned Samuel Pryor, a Republican National Committee from Connecticut and an early Willkie booster. Pryor had previously been introduced to Davis through Arthur Hobson, a Davis & Company employee who knew Pryor from Hobson's connections with the Bank of Boston. Davis asked Pryor to secretly meet with him at Davis's first home in Bronxville, New York, to discuss the possibility of a Lewis endorsement of Willkie. Readily agreeing, Pryor met with Davis a few days later. At this meeting, Davis told Pryor that he was out to defeat Roosevelt and was ready to contribute up to $1 million to that cause. Davis informed Pryor that he would pay for a nationwide radio broadcast in which Lewis would declare for Wilkie. Although no definite assurances had yet come from Lewis, Davis was confident that Lewis would do his bidding. More here about Samuel Fraser Pryor. He was a Republican National Committeeman. He may not have been chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was, however, the conduit, the go-between for Nazi agent William Rhodes Davis in his efforts to get John L. Lewis on board the Wilkie campaign, and that in turn in order to assure Roosevelt's defeat on behalf of William Rhodes Davis's Nazi bosses. Of Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr.'s role in these machinations, we read, Pryor telephoned Wilkie from Davis's home and told him of the oil man's willingness to pay for the Lewis broadcast. Wilkie wanted to immediately meet this mysterious man who would make an offer of such dimensions. Pryor used his private plane to fly Davis to meet with Wilkie, who was then at his home in Rushville, Indiana. After Davis repeated his offer to Wilkie in person, the Republican nominee pointed to the contribution limits of the federal election law and suggested that the money be given to various Wilkie clubs to maintain the legalities. Davis concluded the meeting by reiterating to Wilkie his offer to carry the cost of a nationwide radio speech by his friend John L. Lewis, who would publicly endorse Wilkie. Wilkie later said that he never heard of Davis before being informed that Davis would sponsor the Lewis broadcast, and that he would have rejected the offer if he had known who Davis was. Wilkie's profession of ignorance, however, seems implausible, because by this time, Davis's Nazi connections had been widely publicized in the newspapers. Soon after the Lewis broadcast, Wilkie wrote Davis a letter asking Davis not to publicly endorse him because of the allegations that Davis had German connections. Wilkie's willingness to take Davis's money puts a tarnish on Wilkie's incorruptible image, both because of Davis's known Nazi connections and Wilkie's early public insistence that the federal campaign laws be adhered to in the spirit as well as the letter of the law. When Wilkie was later asked if he was aware of Davis's contributions to the Republican Party, Wilkie lied and said he never knew about these funds. These questionable actions show that Wilkie, like many politicians, was more interested in winning than in the morality of what he had to do to win. At the conclusion of the Davis-Wilkie meeting, an arrangement was made for Wilkie to meet Lewis in New York on the night of September 28th. To prepare for this meeting, Davis and Worley met with Pryor and several other Wilkie supporters, including Gene Tunney, the famous boxer, to discuss his support for Wilkie at New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Pryor wanted assurance that Lewis would endorse Wilkie. Davis said, quote, I'll call Lewis, and I think he's ready to make a pro-Wilkie statement, unquote. Davis telephoned Lewis, and Lewis agreed to endorse Wilkie. Davis returned to the meeting and told Pryor of Lewis's answer, and the Wilkie supporters left the meeting excited about the boost that a Lewis endorsement would give Wilkie's campaign. Soon after, Lewis called Wilkie from Davis's home in Scarsdale to confirm their upcoming meeting. Wilkie met with Lewis at the Manhattan apartment of Samuel Pryor. Joe Martin, the national chairman of the Republican Party, was also present. Late into the night, Lewis and Wilkie engaged in a brisk conversation about their politics. Wilkie's highly personalized campaign needed a shot in the arm. He was trailing in the polls, and a personal endorsement by Lewis just might provide the margin of victory that Wilkie needed. Wilkie wooed Lewis by declaring that when he was elected, he would honor the labor gains won through the New Deal. He did not promise Lewis a post in his cabinet, but Wilkie did say that his Secretary of Labor would come from the ranks of labor. In return, Lewis offered his support if Wilkie agreed to repeat these promises publicly in Wilkie's upcoming labor speech, which was scheduled for Pittsburgh on October 3rd. Wilkie agreed, and their meeting concluded. Wilkie kept his part of the bargain. In a Pittsburgh speech before an audience of 30,000, he promised to uphold the gains made by labor and to appoint someone from the ranks of labor as his Secretary of Labor. Now, it was Lewis's turn to keep his part of the bargain. And operating on behalf of the Republicans and William Rhodes Davis and Republican National Committeeman Samuel Pryor Jr. and the Third Reich, Lewis did just that. Again, notice, by the way, I should correct an earlier statement. Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr. was not chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was a committee member, and he met with Davis and the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Joe Martin, to arrange this. But do note that Samuel Fraser Pryor was the key liaison person between the Republicans and the Rhodes-Davis Nazi milieu, but he was not actually the chairman. Now, turning to Lewis's speech on behalf of the Republicans, Wendell Willkie, and behind that, William Rhodes Davis, Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr., and behind them, the Third Reich, we read, Lewis sent a telegram to Willkie asking him to send his press aide, Paul C. Smith, to Washington to discuss with Lewis the terms on which the labor leader would deliver a speech in support of Wendell Willkie. After working out the details with Smith, Lewis agreed to make his endorsement on October 25th in a nationwide radio broadcast. Lewis was keeping his actions secret. Until 2 weeks before the radio broadcast, Lewis was still assuring some of those closest to him that he would not endorse the Republican candidate. He told one of his aides after his private interview with Willkie that he considered the Republican a man of narrow intellectual outlook with, quote, the mind of a fixer, unquote. During the week before his speech, Lewis retreated into almost total isolation and wrote a Willkie endorsement speech without even consulting his closest associates. A few days before the speech, Lewis met with several high CIO officials and announced that he was coming out for Willkie and was prepared to take full responsibility for his decision and to stand or fall by it. On October 21st, Davis called the three radio networks to schedule a broadcast and identified himself as a personal representative of Lewis. He arranged for the payment of $55,000 for a 30-minute radio broadcast in which John L. Lewis would deliver a speech on the national election to more than 362 stations on all three major radio networks. Davis also paid for the printing of millions of copies of Lewis's speech to be distributed across the country after the broadcast. Davis financed the Lewis broadcast by passing the money to the Democrats for Willkie political committees, which included in its leadership such prominent anti-New Deal Democrats as former presidential candidates Al Smith and John W. Davis. This political committee then paid the radio networks for the broadcast. This indirect arrangement was used to get around the federal campaign finance laws and to hide the source of the contribution. There was a furious exchange of checks to ensure that no one individual would be listed as contributing more than the $5,000 limit of the federal campaign law, and Republican lawyers scanned all the transactions and scrutinized the checks to make sure there were no violations. The White House, who was aware of who paid for Lewis's broadcast almost immediately but chose not to publicize the information until after the election. Skipping down. With an estimated 25 to 30 million listeners, Lewis delivered in his deep baritone voice a bitter attack on Roosevelt and asked trade unionists to oppose his re-election. He accused the president of not ending unemployment and of neglecting labor, but his most emphatic accusation was that he was leading the nation into war. What was the president's objective, asked Lewis. It is war. His every act leads to this inescapable conclusion. The president has said that he hates war and will work for peace, but his acts do not match his words. The president has been scheming for years to involve us in war, unquote. Vehemently denouncing Roosevelt and asserting that his election could very well mean both war and dictatorship, Lewis declared for Willkie. He praised Willkie's integrity and described Willkie as someone who was not an aristocrat, but a common man. He has the common touch. He was born in the briar and not to the purple. He has worked with his hands and has known pangs of hunger, unquote. This description of Willkie was pure fantasy and was intended for Lewis's labor constituents. Lewis then reviewed the candidate's promises and aims, including the promise that Willkie would give labor full representation in his administration. Lewis concluded his speech with a dramatic pledge. He placed his personal prestige squarely on the line in support of the Republican nominee by vowing that if Roosevelt received a third presidential term, he would consider it a vote of no confidence in his own leadership of the CIO. Therefore, he would resign from his position as president of the CIO if Roosevelt were reelected. He implored his followers, quote, sustain me now or repudiate me, unquote. After the speech, Davis and Lewis waited expectantly for labor to move into the Willkie camp. If the CIA vote were captured, it would ensure a Willkie victory. However, virtually all of Lewis's followers, whether they said so or not, were dismayed by his endorsement of Willkie. The pro-Roosevelt faction in the CIO had hoped Lewis would limit himself to vigorous criticism of the president. What had been expected was a vitriolic attack on Roosevelt and a new plague on both your houses, unquote. After his endorsement of Willkie, Lewis pressured union officials to support his stand for Willkie or resign. Several union officials resigned, including the head of Labor's nonpartisan league, Gardner Jackson. Jackson may have been referring to the Davis dealings in his letter of resignation. Quote, "These are critical days when more than ever, men seem to become captives of their personal ambition for wealth, social position, and influence, and when their adventures in power politics and in finance politics, both at home and in the international field, also make them captives." It's possible that Jackson's resignation was closely tied to the Lewis Davis link, because the radio network sent the bill for the broadcast to the Nonpartisan League, which then passed it on to the Democrats for Wilkie. It's likely that Jackson was aware of the source of funding for the broadcast, and that he could not condone taking money from a Nazi sympathizer. So again, the person who was functioning as the liaison between the Republican Party and Nazi agent William Rhodes Davis, in order to help John L. Lewis formally endorse Wendell Willkie and to do so in a speech, basically that was Samuel Fraser Pryor Jr., key member of the Republican National Committee and the son of Samuel Fraser Pryor Sr., part of the Bush family Nazi industry milieu. And one of the things that is important to understand in politics is the factor of inertia. Once things are going in a particular direction, that tends to keep things going in that direction. And as we look at some of the things that the Bush family has done recently, and as we take a look at the elder George Bush's actions in the post-World War II period, one wonders to what extent he basically was carrying on an old family tradition, as Hank Williams Jr. put it. And basically, he simply was taking the institutional inertia, picking it up from where his father, Prescott Bush Sr., had left off. Turning out of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, which is available for download for free from the Spitfire website, reviewing an item that we've looked at many times in the past. As the Third Reich was going down on August 10, 1944, Martin Bormann called a meeting of German industrialists in Strasbourg and Alsace-Lorraine. There they were addressed by Obergruppenführer Dr. Scheid, an SS general, and that was where Bormann, using Scheid as his intermediary and proxy, broke the word for the flight capital program. And among the companies being seen as useful for the Nazi flight capital program was the Hamburg America Line. In this passage from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning is directly excerpting minutes of this meeting from 8-10-44. These minutes were captured by the U.S. Army and were in the Treasury Department's files. Dr. Scheid also affirmed, "The ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war." As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that, quote, patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated New York and Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern. He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. And recall that when the manager of the Bank for Handel and Schifffahrt discovered that that bank was being used in the post-war period for the distribution of Nazi monies abroad, he traveled to New York in order to report this to Prescott Bush Sr., was then found dead, rather mysteriously, a couple of weeks later. In 1996, Dutch journalist Eddie Rover was researching the Bush family's links to Nazi industry, and he went to the United Kingdom to interview Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza. He, too, had been in perfect health, and he, too, turned up dead of a heart attack shortly thereafter. Among the companies that had been used by the Bormann Group to traffic monies abroad was the Banco Alemán Transatlántico. That is cited in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. You can download the whole book for free from the Spitfire website. Also in the description for the Record 305, there is some text excerpt that specifically discusses Banco Alemán Transatlántico. And in some of the documents that are on the website that is linked to the Spitfire website, the role of Banco Alemán Transatlántico and its connections with the Bush family milieu in the post-war period is documented. So again, on the website that's linked to the Spitfire website, there are reproductions of the actual government documents that support, that document the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. One of the American Justice Department people who had come across the links between powerful American industrialists, politicians, and financiers and the luminaries of the Third Reich was a guy named O. John Rogge, last name R-O-G-G-E, who had been in charge of prosecuting a bunch of saboteurs who had landed and tried to blow up a number of key American industrial institutions. Turning once again to the book Mystery Man, we're going to take a look now at who frustrated O. John Rogge's attempts at making this information public. Rogge first came across the links between American industrialists and financiers and their German counterparts when on a trip to Germany. The Rogge mission painstakingly scrutinized thousands of confidential documents from the files of the German War Ministry, Foreign Office, Propaganda Ministry, and Abwehr. Rogge later said, "Our investigation showed us that we had completely underestimated the scope and scale of Nazi activities in the United States. When I went to Germany, I felt that the biggest threat to American democracy emanated from the machinations of persons like the defendants in the sedition trial. I found that a far more dangerous threat lay in the interconnections between German and American industrialists, and that some of the best-known names in America were involved in Nazi intrigue." When Rogge returned to Washington toward the end of June, he was confident that he had uncovered sufficient evidence to warrant federal prosecution of a number of Americans. Working at fever pitch, Rogge began preparing a comprehensive report to Attorney General Clark on the voluminous data he had collected in Germany. In early July, this is 1946, Rogge submitted to Clark a draft first section of his report. To Rogge's surprise, the report's references to links between the Germans and American business and political leaders clearly disturbed Clark. After reading the report, Clark declared that it could not possibly be published and would have to remain a secret document. Rogge was not happy with Clark's proposal and asked that Clark hold off on a final decision until the report was completed. Rogge continued to work on the report through August. As he neared the end, one of Clark's aides proposed that Rogge omit all names of American politicians and businessmen. Rogge refused. By the time Rogge finished writing the report, he knew that the Department of Justice would never agree to publish his findings. Accordingly, he decided that he might as well put everything in the report, regardless of whether it was politically expedient. The incendiary final recommendation of the report was for the Justice Department to begin an investigation of the collaboration between German and American industrialists before the war. On September 17, 1946, Rogge delivered his 396-page report to Attorney General Clark. As Rogge expected, Clark told him, quote, "the report would not be made public," unquote. Rogge then went on a college speaking tour and began leaking some of the key aspects in this report on that tour, and then we're going to see what happened. Skipping down, on the morning of October 25th, Rogge left New York by plane for a speaking engagement in Seattle, Washington. Due to bad weather, the plane made an unscheduled stop in Spokane. At the airport, Rogge was informed that there was no room for him on the next leg of the flight. Stuck in Spokane, he was told that a Mr. Savage was on his way to the airport to see him. Soon afterward, a man approached Rogge at the airport and said, "My name's Savage. I'm from the Federal Bureau of Investigation." He handed Rogge an envelope. The envelope contained a letter to Rogge from Attorney General Clark. The letter notified Rogge that he was dismissed from the Justice Department immediately. Clearly, the FBI had been following Rogge and had arranged to keep him in Spokane so that he could be handed his termination letter. Attorney General Clark wanted Rogge's authority as a federal official stripped away before he could speak at another college. Tom Clark here, the Attorney General who fired John Rogge and who effected this cover-up of Rogge's attempts at disclosing the links between German and American industrialists and financiers, that Tom Clark is the father of Ramsey Clark, yet another Attorney General. Ramsey Clark, as Attorney General, in addition to helping cover up the assassinations of both Kennedys and Martin Luther King, has, among other things, opposed the establishment of the Office of Special Investigations, the Justice Department unit that was headed up by John Loftus, that was in charge with investigating Nazis brought into the United States. So Ramsey Clark as well, following in the footsteps of some very ignoble predecessors, in this case his father Tom Clark, who helped to cover up some of these prior offenses. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 475, Prior Offenses, being recorded on September 12th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.